Welcome to the Australian CISO, a podcast for current and aspiring chief information security officers and anyone interested in cybersecurity. My name is Richard Herron. I am the host of the Australian CISO and proud to think there are listeners in 38 countries of the world. All opinions you hear on this podcast are my own or those of the people being interviewed. They do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the companies that I or the interviewees are employed by. The podcast is recorded with Audacity using a Rode Podcaster microphone and hosted on Podomatic. Hi everyone and welcome back to the Australian CISO podcast. This is the podcast for anyone employed in cybersecurity or for anyone who wants to obtain a position in the cybersecurity industry. Today is Saturday, October 28, and this is episode 43. Today I'll be playing part one of an interview I did with cybersecurity advocate and regular speaker Jason Morrell. We did this interview at a recent Adapt Security One Day get-together in Melbourne. We spoke for about an hour, so I've split the episode into two, as well as cutting out a bit of irrelevant chatter between Jason and myself. On to the episode. It's interesting with these free-flowing interviews, you just can't predict which way the conversation will flow, and you'll certainly find that the first 7 to 8 minutes of the discussion doesn't really relate to cybersecurity, but it is well worth listening to hear how Jason went through different paths to ultimately find himself in cybersecurity. Here's part one of the interview with Jason Morrell. Hi everyone, we are at a security event today called Security Edge. It's hosted by Adapt, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Jason Morrell. Hello Jason, how are you?
Hi Richard, very well, and good to see you here. It's been a while.
It has been a while. We've conversed a lot over LinkedIn, but never much in person. So now that we've bribed you to speak, a real quick answered question is, what is your title? Who do you work for?
Currently, I just work for myself. Okay. And so I'm just doing cybersecurity consulting more generally in the market now. Okay. Prior to that, I was at Osiris as group executive and finished up in August this year. And off the back of that, yeah, I've just been doing a lot of consulting and just getting on to events like this.
Cool. So why don't we go back, way back when? You presumably went to school.
Yeah.
When you finished school.
Not well.
Not well, well, join the club. When you finished school, I presume like year 11, year 12, what was your next step?
Yeah, next step, interestingly enough, was actually, I got into computers very early because...
What year would have that been?
Don't ask that question, that's probably...
Come on.
It's late 80s. So I actually went and worked for a shop fitting sign writing company.
Okay.
So this is a story I don't share very often, but...
No one listens to this podcast
No, I do. So I'll listen to myself back, that'd be really interesting. But I actually left school and went... The first job I actually went to do, I wanted to actually work as a chef. But during that summer, I actually worked as a kitchen hand in a kitchen. The hours and everything like that, I thought, it's not for me. I didn't like it. It was sort of interfering with social life. All my friends were going out Friday, Saturday nights, and I was working till 1, 2, 3 in the morning cleaning pots and pans, you know, on the key nights, Fridays and Saturdays. And I thought, not for me. And I only lasted a couple of months doing that job. But then I actually got a job working at a sign writing and shop fitting company. And then I went into photography, so that was the sort of next stage.
And how did you get into photography? Had you always had an interest in photography?
Photography was something I had an interest in. This was back in before digital cameras.
Yep.
But Mum actually worked at Channel 10, and she worked on a show called The Bert Newton Show, so this could be past the timeline for a few people.
I have heard of it, yeah, yes.
But there was a guy on there, Shane Monopoly used to go on there, and he did this thing, get your hair and makeup done, and it was $50. Now, back in the day, like we... As photographers, we were getting paid $20, and the makeup artist would get paid $30. But his real money was when they come in and see how good the photos look, because they'd be all professional TV makeup artists, and you know, they'd come in, get their hair and makeup done, and we'd do the photography, and they'd walk out, average spend $500, you know, for buying a portrait or photos and all that, because they're looking fantastic, you know, sort of thing. And that first year, and again, another entrepreneurial guy, I sat there and saw he'd turn over $3.2 million in the first year, and only 27% of that was sort of cost, you know, and that sort of thing. So that business kept going along. He kept opening studios all around Australia. But long story short, I then tried to do my own replica of that. I saw how he was doing it. And we set up our own studio in Fitzroy Street here in St Kilda in Melbourne and tried to do our own stuff. But it was a lot harder. And this is where it sort of pivoted into finance. And then I had to go refinance my house and went to Westpac, who was my financier at the time, for the home loan. And in asking about that and saying, how can I refinance, I'd learned a bit about finance from, you know, Darren, the first guy. And the lady behind the counter said, oh, we're actually looking to recruit people to work in financial planning. Huh. We'll cover the cost of all the thing. Would you be interested in doing that? I was like, okay. So
I was there to refinance
the house, and then I got into financial planning. And this was another sort of sliding doors moment. There was, working at Westpac, they were getting investigated by ASIC for non-disclosure. So, you know, when you get your financial planning done, what was happening is they were charging fees at the back end, but the client didn't know. So the planners were recommending things that might have given them a better commission rather than what was best for the client on the other side of the fence. So I was used as the person that would actually be used. And sometimes I'd have a person from ASIC and a person from Westpac in the office. So before I sat down with, okay, Richard, before we go in the room, just have to let you know that we're testing out a new advisory services guide. Due to that, we're going to have a couple of people present in the room from both ASIC and Westpac. Yep. This is for your protection, so to make sure you know that there's fees included in here. So I was the guinea pig, basically, to go through the advisory services guide and say, here's the fees that you may be charged, maximum and minimums and all that sort of stuff. So I went through all that sort of thing. I remember going to then 360 Collins Street here in Melbourne, and we had to have a meeting. I had to be present with the CEO at the time, who, just seeing him operate just sort of blew my mind. I just, you know, corporate Australia, you don't understand how it works when you're just a youngster. And I remember sitting in the room, and ASIC had sort of come with a list of, you know, a laundry list of about 12 or 13 things they wanted to see changed in the industry, and they wanted Westpac to be the lead of that. And he sat down.
This is the CEO of Westpac.
Wow. He sort of came in with his PA. She sort of put a note there, and he sat down and goes, okay, so which of these ones do you want to pick? So pick three on the list, and then we'll consider them and maybe do one of them from there.
Yep.
And then he walked out of the meeting. And then we had a sort of tea break, and then everyone's sitting around the table like, what just happened there? But when we were sort of talking in the hallway, he'd actually, and I follow AFL Richmond Football Club, he was at Canberra University. Richmond Football Club tried to transfer him down the early 70s down to play for Richmond. They couldn't get the transfer through for whatever reason. He kicked like almost 200 goals or something in the Canberra competition. Instead, he couldn't get there. He went over to London and worked at some banks in London. That's how he then ended up coming to be a CEO at Westpac.
He never ended up playing in the VFL?
Never did, no. So he missed out on that transfer window and then went over to London, worked at some of the bigger banks in London, came back, and then, so that was his sliding door moment. He said, if I went and played football, I might not have actually got the career and ended up in the pathway of doing what I did.
Here's something for you. So a lot of listeners will be saying, this Jason Morrell guy is a cyber guy. He's now talking about finance. How did you move from finance, from this Westpac work you're doing, into cyber? Or was cyber not your next move?
No, well, from finance. So it was capital raising, and this is how I got into cyber. So I'll probably skip into that.
Sure.
You're very restricted in a bank on what you can recommend. So even doing all that, and even after that 9 months, and I got paid better than the average rate because it was going to restrict sales, obviously, from doing what we were doing. But I still ended up being in the top three of advisors in there because I was trying to give the right advice, but you're very restricted. You have a wholesale fund and you're restricted what you can do. I had actually attended a seminar about finance more broadly and ended up moving to a finance company up in Sydney, and which was more capital raising, and that's where I did a tyre recycling plant, started a gold business that got listed on the stock exchange. So in 2003,
a gold business.
It was a gold site remediation technology that listed on the ASX in 2011. So I sort of co-founded that with someone and then learned about sort of funding and using finance. You know, it's almost like you've got to print your own money because you issue shares at nil consideration, and as investors come in, your bits of paper then become worth something, you know. And so I grew that company and exited. The other one, Starwood Whiskey, which a lot of people know that I was founding shareholder of that one. In 2007, they got bought out by Diageo, but it moved into capital raising. And the stuff that happened with cyber, to skip real forward and get into the real stuff we should be talking about, was actually a good friend of mine started a company called New Domain, which was a domain name and hosting company for Australian domain names, Jonathan Horn. And we get into cyber security off the back of this one, because New Domain, we had about 45,000 customers, and we had a customer one day sort of ring up and say, because we'd sold domain names and mail hosting or email hosting and web hosting, and one of our email clients who were hosted with us had actually had a phishing attack. So they rang us up and said, hey, you sold us the email hosting, we got hacked, your problem, your fault. So off the back of that call, Richard, we then started to investigate what had actually happened. It wasn't our fault. It actually had been the end user had been sent an overquota Office 365 email, clicked on the link. They'd watched the email account for about 3 weeks. They'd seen that they do, it was a small law firm up on the Gold Coast, they do a for the houses, the settlements.
Yep.
There was three properties to the value, I think it was $782,000. They'd stopped the emails in the outbox, they'd changed their bank details, classic that we know now, but back in sort of 2017, we hadn't seen that sort of thing before ourselves, and the money had gone.
Another well-known, I'll say Australian data breach was, I forget the company name, but it was Alex Randall and his brother.
Yep.
They were in the domain name industry as well.
Yeah, I know Alex pretty well, yeah.
Coincidental.
Hey? So, yeah, and so, yeah, Jono and he had been in the same space, and I know Alex very well. But yeah, that was the sort of thing. So then what we started to do then, Rich, is look at our own business and say, actually, we need to look at where we host. So we've got our own hosting environment, you know, jump boxes, data at rest, the whole sort of nine yards. But where we got into cyber was from CyberAware. We went start to look at, we had internal people. How do we train our own people about cybersecurity? And when we were investigating, I think really it was only Know Before and Cofence were probably the only ones, which were Fishme at the time.
Yeah.
And they were very American-centric with their templates. So, you know, they might have had a dozen or so, maybe templates of, yeah, you know, the main banks and stuff like that. But in the scheme of things, it wasn't very useful or fit for purpose. So Jono, being the smart cookie he was, said, I think we can make something better ourselves. Let's have a crack. So we'd sort of developed a skin, and I went to market to finance, and this is where linking back to finance. I knew people at, you know, finance companies, accounting firms. We went hand to hand in the market at first point, see if we could sell it. We sold it with the skin, and then John and I had to madly sit down and create this product, you know, from scratch over a sort of 3 week period. And John didn't sleep very much for a few weeks, but that's how CyberAware sort of began.
Yeah.
And then it's morphed into being a white label solution more for MSPs and MSSPs. So unless you deeply dig into the DNS, you won't find that we're actually behind the product.
Gotcha.
We were never going to be able to go head-to-head with Know Before, yeah, or Cofence. At the time, Know Before just had $1 billion invested in the company. Yeah. They did try and acquire us, which is probably another story for another time, a year or so later. But, you know, because it's sort of been built up without any external capital and everything, we're happy just to let that run. And that's ticking along nicely sort of as we speak. And that was the entry point in. Then from there was Six Clicks, which was a GRC sort of machine learning AI platform, which is, you know, sort of going leaps and bounds, and then CyberHive into there. And then I'd been involved in Acer, you know, as cloud branch chair in there, get into AusCyber, you know, and sort of help, you know, sort of resurrect that or finish off the projects that were happening.
Can you talk
in
a bit about AusCyber?
Yes, yeah, so AusCyber was set up, I think, in Malcolm Turnbull's time around 2017 as one of the growth centres. So remember at the time, Malcolm Turnbull was talking about, you know, being more of a, using our brains and innovation as part, yep, of how we should develop as a country, which, you know, I think is still obviously as relevant now as it was then. And AusCyber was born out of that. AusCyber was a growth centre, so funded by Dicer. So they put in over the time, something in the order of $30 million into cyber, into that area over that period of time there. And the works were really to grow, export, and educate the market, and that was the main tenets of the business there. So, a lot of successful things happened in there. There's probably things in hindsight we could all say we could do better, but cyber's still very new now, and it was obviously very new at the time. So, it was steered through to start with by Michelle Price mainly. I think Craig started, and then Michelle Price sort of went through there. They merged during COVID with Stone & Chalk. And then it sort of just changed then. And I think it's just come to its natural conclusion. You know, the funding was ending at June 30 this year, as we're speaking now. We're October 2023. But there's another year just to finish off all the projects up until, you know, sort of June 30 next year.
So when you mentioned Six Clicks before, did you actually start that business?
Or were
you
Anthony Stevens and Andrew Robinson. So I knew Andrew. And I remember when Andrew first came to me, I didn't know a great deal of GRC. Like, I knew the basics of, you know, ISO and NIST and all that sort of stuff. I didn't realise how... He was an IRAP assessor, and he showed me... The thing that got me, Richard, was when he first showed me his Excel spreadsheet with 37 tabs of different, you know, metrics that you need. You can be measured across in governance, risk and compliance. And his pitch was really clean and really simple, is that, you know, what if you had a single pane of glass to look at all that through? Because he was sort of saying to me, imagine if I send the sheet on to you, Richard, that I've made some changes in this section, send it to you and I haven't saved the macros or whatever's happened, and you get it and you make some changes. And he said this happens often when you're passing around. Also, though, that there's a lot of similarities across all the metrics, you know, so there's, you know, just say passwords or something that's fairly similar across all metrics. He said what we're trying to build and what they have built is a single pane of glass where you say all the things we need to be compliant with are in this single pane.
Yeah.
The machine learning and AI and the generative AI has been really helpful, especially over the last 12 months or so. They look at those questions and they can actually say, these three, four questions are actually 98.7% the same. Answer this one question, you'll answer four. You know, so it's trying to level down to say, also then if an update becomes available within that GRC component, then it would say, ISO's made some changes, goes through the system, you had a green flag there, now Richard has flagged as orange because that system's changed there. It'll flag the person in the organisation to make the changes and all that sort of stuff. So the compliance metric, what we'll do is tag someone in IT to say you need to make the change, or someone in accounting or whatever the case may be, log it in their calendar, put it in there, and it just registers that it has been done on this date. We're up to the space, we're compliant and whatever the case may be.
Sounds like a worthwhile tool. So AusCyber, your involvement finished
in August this year, as I say, it sort of had come to its natural conclusion. I think most of the projects were sort of winding up, you know, so it was sort of mutually agreed to sort of move on to the next phase.
What's interesting is that, so I've seen your profile on LinkedIn, not that I've delved deep into it, but I think, Jason's a security guy, he must have been doing security for a good 20 years. But in reality, you've only been doing it for 5 or 6 years. You've moved from signwriting, photography, here, there, everywhere, to security. What was your favourite industry? Is it cyber?
It is. Look, I think once I got the bug for cyber, it's something you can really help people in. You know, I got a kick out of doing something creative, and creative was doing the signage and the shop fitting, and I can still drive past now buildings where I've got signs that are still sitting there.
Yeah.
You know, and it's still, like, I drive past police stations, the big blue and white checkered sign is still standing there. Thankfully, you know, after all these years that we obviously use the right sort of paint on them and the vinyl letters are still sticking as they should. Yeah. But it's, you know, doing stuff with cybersecurity where you can try and make a difference, and I think, you know, as a collective, bringing stuff together and people together.
So that's what you like about it, you can help people. Is there anything that frustrates you about...
Yeah, I think how disjointed we are as a nation. I think we collectively could do things a lot better. And there's other countries.
What, just collaborate?
Yeah, collaborate more. A lot more. There's a lot of people sort of running off and doing the same things.
Yeah.
But if they actually joined forces, we could actually do it a lot better.
But I mean, you'd know a lot of the banks talk to each other.
Yep.
The retailers, I think, talk to each other. The health industries talk to each other. Is that sort of on the way, on the journey to what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think it's also more of the supportive mechanisms around that as well. So I think and one of the pieces of work we were doing at AusCyber was the accreditation piece or professionalisation of the industry. And so around that table, to bring everyone together was actually a real challenge, to bring ISACA, ICS Squared, ACS, you know, all the major bodies together, and all the universities, the TAFEs and everyone, to get some sort of agreement on what the curriculum should look like going forward, you know, and what is a cyber professional. So, you know, and I think getting it to the point, Richard, where it's almost like, you know, when you play a game, if you do online sports, I'm not a big online gamer, but when I was younger, I used to didn't mind playing FIFA, you know, the old soccer game, and you get a player and it'd be a striker who's 76%, and here's their skills, their speed, their goal, sense and all that sort of stuff. I think we need to build that. So GRC is an example. We've got Mary here, who's a GRC professional, has worked in the finance area, is proficient in NIST and all that sort of stuff. Her score might be 76, mid-level.
Yeah.
And so if you're looking to employ someone, you know the pay range for that. You know, and we had Ricky Burke involved and a few other people as well to say it's going to make the employment part easier because we say this person's skilled, but also it makes it easy for the person to say, actually, I want to get to the next level. What do I need to study or what do I need to do next to get to the next level of skill?
This might contradict two things. This first one might contradict what you said, but what gets me, a lot of people who apply for jobs, you know, I've got CISSP, I've got CISM, I've got SIS, I've got everything. Just because you can pass an exam doesn't mean...
You haven't applied it.
Yeah.
Yep.
But, and the second thing is, it's interesting you talked about like playing FIFA and the different ratings. Having done jiu-jitsu, I don't do it anymore, but I did it for about 5 years, and you get to know the belts, you know, white, blue, purple, brown and black. And I've often thought, you know, with security, could we do that? So maybe could you have CISOs kind of a black belt level, and then more experienced get one stripe, two stripe, three stripe. You know, a head of is a brown belt, but how would you measure that?
That's a good point, Richard, because I think the thing is, if you look at it, some CISOs are very technically proficient and they've got very good skill there, but maybe their weakness might be actually dealing with boards, you know, or the people management or skill part. So what we can do then is say, you're great at this technical part and you actually really get it. You don't mind getting your hands dirty and getting on the tools. Yeah. But as a CISO, what the CISO role at this business needs is someone who has more board skills and actually people manage and do that sort of stuff. So can we develop that for that person to then get them to that next level?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, it's probably take a while.
Yeah, no, I was just saying, it's something that the FAQs that are on that and that first piece of work, and there will be a second piece of work that comes on. So the first piece of work was completed, and that's the ASP program, so the Cybersecurity Professional Program. But the part two of that, you bring more people in, it goes in market. Look, we're really looking 25, 26 until that sort of thing probably comes in play, but only Australia and the UK are the only two trying to crack that nut at the moment. So, you know, the US sort of haven't touched it, and there is a lot of opinions around that one. So let it play out and see what happens. But there needs to be something where if someone's in the market and you're trusting them as a site professional, what are your credentials? Because there's a lot of people that are wandering around in the market at the moment purporting to do certain things that they can't.
I've got to say, I find the interview process, it's a lottery. Oh, I've done this. And you hire them and maybe they're not so great or not so proactive as they told you in the interview. Have you got any tips for interviewing? Is it just a matter of having your criteria?
Sometimes you've got to test. I think you've got to test. You know, we talk about, and you and I have spoken about it before, is, you know, if you really want to test your cybersecurity plan, one person in the business knows about it, and we've spoken about this and agree wholeheartedly on this, do a proper attack where no one knows about it except for the CISO or someone in the team, and let's see how it plays out, right? Sometimes I think in the hiring process, if you're hiring someone for a specific position, put them in a real life test. Yeah, it's like you can manually read a manual about driving a car, but then the actual physicality of actually driving a car and doing that is a different scenario. Yeah. So I think we need to get people driving vehicles.
And on that analogy, if I said to you, and you know what, Jason, tomorrow at 9 o'clock, I'm going to get in the car with you and you're going to drive right down Bourke Street, Melbourne. You'll prepare for that. You'll get, I need to do this, I need to do that. You'll make sure you get a good night's sleep.
We're going to Ballarat now.
Not yet. And it's the same with, what you said, doing an instant response, I suppose a blue team, red team event. If I tell you that we're going to do that tomorrow, you're going to tell all your stuff, get ready, look at the screens, it's happening, all that. It's better. The hackers don't give you a warning, and they don't give a hoot whether you're on annual leave when you're in the middle of installing Windows 12 or whatever it is. They don't care. They just do it.
Yeah.
So, and it's the same with an instant response. That would be a good true test. Just do it.
Yeah. I think that's the thing, is because we interview and we ask the questions, and people always, if they're going for a job, will give you, I'll talk to these people for reference. They're not going to give you people who are going to call them an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think the best way is to often test. I mean, we do have that period of, you know, 3 or 6 months sort of probation, but in cybersecurity, sometimes you can't afford to waste that time and pick the wrong person. The person that could have been second choice may be better and maybe didn't interview so well because they're more introverted.
Yes.
They don't get the role and they could have been perfect for it, but you just didn't know. And, you know,
I think it's a really good point. I've interviewed people who interview very well. They're very well spoken, just like yourself.
Mm.
And then there's others
Don't employ me. We know that.
And there's other people who go, and ah like me.
Mm.
How do you know that the MR person is not a reflector and they're just the type of person who just needs to go away and think about stuff and apply, whereas the ones who answer the questions perfectly, maybe they're just marketeers, maybe they just know how to sell themselves.
Yeah, I think we need diversity.
Well, folks, that was part one of the two-part episode with Jason Morrell. I will release part two within the next week or so. Ooh, before I go, last week I mentioned I played a game of golf with my friend Paul and he won the game. I mentioned I'd be back this week to hopefully tell you that I had beaten him today. Drumroll! Well, Paul did not win the game. Nor did I. It was a draw. Oh well, there's always next week. Yibbida yibbida. That's all, folks. Time to go. See ya.